Okay, our topic for tonight is the life and career of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, Samson Raphael Hirsch, who is credited as being the founder of Neo-Orthodoxy. We're not going to really speak about Neo-Orthodoxy tonight, actually. We're going to speak about Hirsch, the man, and the trajectory of his career. God willing, next week we'll discuss his main competitor, who is Ezriel Hildesheimer and the founder of the rabbinical school in Berlin, and we'll discuss the training of rabbis, and maybe the week after that we'll finally discuss the social dynamic that is Neo-Orthodoxy, the movement proper. Okay.
What do they call him, Shamshon?
Shamshon?
What kind of name is Shamshon?
Shimshon is the biblical name. Shamshon, I guess, was a Germanic bastardization of the biblical name.
His mother called him.
And his name was not Shamshon Raphael, it was Shamshon Ben Raphael. His father was Raphael Hirsch. Okay, so he was born in Hamburg in 1808, and he came from an enlightened religious family. The group of enlightened religious Jews in Germany at the turn of the 19th century was a small contingent in an unenviable position, because they were too enlightened for the Orthodox and too religious for the Reform. They were neither here nor there. This crowd would admire Rambam's Mora Nevuchim, the Maimonides' Guide for the Perplexed, and Mendelssohn's Biur, his commentary on the Torah. But they would disdain Kabbalah and Hasidism, which was then on the march in the East. Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's father, Raphael Hirsch, was born 1777, dies 1857, was clean-shaven, and loved to study the Bible. The fact that someone is known to love to study the Bible is already a suspicious thing. His paternal grandfather was Mendel Frankfurter, who was born 1742 and dies 1823. Now notice the change in last name. Frankfurter becomes Hirsch. Why, I'm not exactly sure, but it's indicative of a time when all Jews have to take on last names, and sometimes they take on one that they didn't have in previous generations.
After the name of the city,
yeah.
Very common, and Hirsch most probably was an occupation.
Could be. So, Mendel Frankfurter was a great Judaic scholar. He studied under Yonatan Eibeschitz and was a dayan in Altona, which is next to Hamburg. But Hirsch's grandfather, Mendel Frankfurter, refused to hold a rabbinical position despite the fact that he was qualified to do so. And the reason why he refused the rabbinical position was, well, possibly multiple reasons, but one important one is that the Emden Eibeschitz controversy of the 1750s and 60s soured him on the rabbinate. In fact, may have soured many other people on the rabbinate. The rabbinate took a hit because of this internal feud. This fratricidal feud.
Was Shabtai Tzviism really strong at this point after the feud?
Not really. I mean, there's Frankism, but it's not as big as it once was, no. Mendel Frankfurter knew Mendelssohn personally and held him in high esteem, despite the fact that all the big rabbis of the second half of the 18th century had their suspicions of Mendelssohn. Eibeschitz, remember, refused to give Mendelssohn smicha. Emden had a run-in with Mendelssohn over the issue of delayed burial in 1772. Yecheskel Lando, Ezekiel Lando of Prague, was very suspicious of Mendelssohn and didn't like the Biur. And Raphael Cohen of Hamburg put the Biur in excommunication. So for a person who was in the rabbinical elite to be so favorably disposed towards Mendelssohn shows that the grandfather of Hirsch was basically a maskil. Now, in 1805...
So which one was close to admire Mendelssohn? Same as
Raphael? His grandfather.
Why do you say he was a maskil?
Because he was.
What?
I think that he was. I think it's clear that Mendel Frankfurter had an affinity and an affection for not just Mendelssohn, but also Wessely, Naftali Herz Wessely, as we'll see right now. In 1805, he opened the Talmud Torah in Hamburg. The problem with the Judaic education in Hamburg was that the old Talmud Torahs were led by Polish Malamdim, old Polish Malamdim of the sort that was no longer really in place and didn't fit the German climate. So he wanted a modern Talmud Torah, where you'd have a maskilic curriculum, secular studies and Judaic studies. As Wesley said in his famous epistle, Divrei Shalom Vemet, in 1782, you want Torah Ta'adam and Torah Elohim, the Torah of man and the Torah of God, secular studies and Judaic studies. So the grandfather of Hirsch establishes this Hamburg Talmud Torah. Hirsch's uncle, Moses Frankfurter, so his father's brother, was known as the Moses Mendelssohn of Hamburg. He was a great maskil. When you're known as the Moses Mendelssohn of Hamburg, it means that you're a great maskil. He wrote Pnei Tevel, which stressed Haskalah values, which meant modernization of education, decorum in the synagogue, and an aversion to the following things: Pilpul, Kabbalah, and Chassidut. Bad, all bad. No good.
Why?
They're backward. Primitive. Not for the modern times.
Kabbalah,
absolutely. Sure, yeah. All right. Now, Hirsch's parents sent him in his youth to a German grammar school. Basically, he went to a public school. He went to a Goyishe school.
This is now Samson Raphael.
Samson Raphael went to a Goyishe school as a child, despite the fact that his parents were enlightened religious people, and his grandfather, who was still alive at the time, was the founder of the Hamburg Talmud Torah. Samson Raphael didn't go to the Hamburg Talmud Torah. Why not? It was his grandfather's school, and he's a religious boy growing up in a religious family. Why go to a Gentile school?
Tuition.
So the answer, so tuition plays a role, but not the one you would think. It wasn't that the yeshiva was too expensive; it was too cheap. It's that the Talmud Torah was an institution for the poor, for the socioeconomic downtrodden, and not for the bourgeois middle class. And Hirsch's family regarded themselves as solidly middle class, if not a little bit above that. So to go to school with the kids from the poor homes was pasnished. You shouldn't do that. But moreover, his parents wanted him to go into a lucrative business career. They had no intention of him becoming a member of the cloth, a clergyman. So if you're going to have a career in business, you need to have great secular education. Therefore, go to the Gentile school. Don't go to the Talmud Torah. That even if it is an enlightened Talmud Torah, still the quality of secular education will be inferior compared to that of the German grammar school.
So was the Talmud Torah inferior? Was it a decent education? Was just
Clearly, Hirsch's parents didn't think it was good enough. Later on, when Hirsch is himself in charge of the situation and developing his own institutions, he'll create what amounts to a modern Orthodox day school in which there is both secular and Judaic education. When we get to a few weeks from now, we discuss the quality of that education, we'll find that the Judaic component was diminished steadily over time in favor of more and more secular. Okay.
Well, what was Talmud Torah then? Talmud Torah was a full day of just Judaic studies?
The traditional ones, absolutely, yeah. There was nothing of secular studies unless it was an overtly enlightened one, in which case they studied things which were of practical concern to earning a livelihood.
So nobody was getting. How did they do about livelihood? Nobody got a secular.
You went into an apprenticeship when you were of age, when you were 12, 13, when it was time to leave school. Okay. So in the American context, Talmud Torah means after school, supplemental. It doesn't mean that in this context. Okay. So the Talmud Torah also was too far to the right religiously for Hirsch's parents, and the Freishul, the free school, which was the one founded by the non-religious Maskilim, was too far to the left. Therefore, the best bet was to go to a non-Jewish school. While doing this, Hirsch was exposed to, from his parents, some areas of Judaic study. But, lest you think that he was jumping headlong into Talmud, that's not the case. In his memoirs, he recalls that he was first exposed to the religious, ethical, and aesthetic portions of the Bible before he had any exposure to the oral law, to the Gemara. So in other words, there was a logical progression in his Judaic studies, something that is typically absent from the classical yeshiva trajectory, where there's nothing logical at all about why you start Gemara at a very early age without a firm grounding in the Bible or the Mishnah. So there's something coherent about this, yes?
That what you're saying is, did a lot of yeshivas do have that progression. Is Rabbi in Israel?
Okay, so in modern Israel, you do have the alternatives which follow the tradition of Pirkei Avot, of Ben Chamesh Shanim LeMikra, Esther Shanim LeMishnah, Chamesh Yisrael LeGemara. You do the whole Bible, or the bulk of the Bible first, then the bulk of the Mishnah, then you get into the Gemara. But that's on the margins. It doesn't exist back then. Yeah.
The English public schools would have congregation, church services.
Yeah.
What about the non-Jewish public schools that you're referring to? Did they have Christian-leaning
Yes, the answer is there were some non-denominational schools, but your average government-sponsored school had elements of Christianity exposed, you know, with which they exposed the children. Because after all, Germany, even after the emancipation, and certainly 60 years before the emancipation, was a Christian state. When the Jews are emancipated in 1870, even then, that just means that they don't have any civic disabilities. It doesn't mean that Judaism is on par with Christianity. Christianity remains the bedrock of civilization, and therefore also part of the education of the youth.
And so Hirsch went to what type of day school, so to
speak? A school that had...
Christian
language. Yeah, sure. So...
He had siblings, yeah?
Yes.
And they went also?
I don't know. So, Isaac Bernays came to Hamburg as the rabbi in 1821. We mentioned his name before. After the Hamburg Temple controversy, the Jewish community hired Bernays because he was a moderate Orthodox rabbi. And the feeling was that if you hire a progressive Orthodox rabbi with a modern flavor, with English, with German language sermon and decorous synagogue service, that will nip in the bud the desire for radical reform. So was Bernays a significant influence in the life of Samson Raphael Hirsch? So some of the historical writings about the life and career of Hirsch say that Bernays was a major influence on him. However, there's no evidence that that's true. He came when Hirsch was a bar mitzvah boy, and Hirsch never claimed in his own writings, although he was very sparing in ascribing any credit to anyone about influencing him, he never really mentions that Bernays was an important influence in his life. However, he did probably have one significant influence, and that's where Hirsch would eventually study for the rabbinate. In 1826, Hirsch went to a gymnasium rather than a yeshiva. At the age of 18... he wants to finish his so-called high school degree so that he could then go on to university. If he were really pursuing the rabbinate, what should he do? Go to a traditional yeshiva and learn Talmud rigorously for a few years. But he doesn't do that. He goes to the gymnasium, and then in 1828, he just finally goes to study under a great rabbi. And probably at Bernays' suggestion, he goes to Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger. Yaakov Ettlinger, who was the author of the Aruch Lenair, was one of the first German rabbis to have a PhD, and despite his modern tendencies, was an old world rabbi, basically. And
PhD from where?
I don't remember which German, a German university, I forget which one. I don't know, but it doesn't matter. What matters is that he had one. He didn't pursue an academic career of that of a professor. He was an old world rabbi who authored halachic treatises and Talmudic commentaries, and was a great figure in the 19th century rabbinate.
What's his name again?
Yaakov Ettlinger. So Hirsch goes to study under him at Mannheim instead of going to a full-fledged yeshiva. Now, those yeshivas did still exist in Germany. They were on the decline. This was not the greatest era of the German yeshiva, but still, Rabbi Akiva Eger had a yeshiva in Posen where there are over 1,000 Talmidim. Why doesn't Hirsch go to a real yeshiva? Why instead does he study privately under Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger? So, an answer that Noah Rosenblum, who wrote the authoritative work on Hirsch, suggests is that Hirsch would have been embarrassed at the age of 20 to begin studies in a major yeshiva because the little teenage boys would have known more than him. It would have been terribly embarrassing for him to come into the yeshiva as a freshman pursuing the rabbinate when he's already an old man at the age of 20 by the standards of the time.
Maybe
he needs one-on-one attention as opposed to the setting of a large yeshiva. But while he's there in Mannheim learning with Ettlinger, he meets an interesting fellow. He meets his best new friend, Abraham Geiger. So Hirsch and Abraham Geiger was 2 years younger than Hirsch, are studying for the rabbinate, and they become very close friends.
Under Ettlinger.
Under Ettlinger's tutelage. But just a year and a half or 2 years after spending time in the yeshiva, under the tutelage of the Rebbe, they both go off to the University of Bonn for academic education. And while they have spare time on the side, they study as Chavrusa, Talmud, and Midrash. So Geiger and Hirsch are Chavrusa, learning Gemara while also going to college. But then their paths diverge, because Geiger remains in a university setting, not at Bonn, but makes the rounds to the various German universities, eventually gets his PhD writing on what aspects of Judaism were borrowed by Islam, by nascent Islam. Whereas Hirsch leaves the university after three semesters, after a year and a half, in 1830. Why did Hirsch leave the university? This is one of the great questions in the biography of Samson Raphael Hirsch, and where the hagiography and the ultra-Orthodox hagiography departs from the actual truth. So the ultra-Orthodox hagiography, along the lines of the biography written of him, published by Art Scroll, says that he left because he had only entered the university because he desired a taste of Gentile culture. But having had the taste of Gentile culture, it was genug, must speak enough, and he can move on in his career as a modern rabbi. That's not really what happened. What really happened was he had an offer he couldn't refuse. It was suggested that he be given the position of Landesrabbiner, the regional rabbi in Oldenburg, which was in northwest Germany. It was a small community of only about 700 Jews spread around over a range of minor communities, with Oldenburg being the main seat of the region. And it was an enticing job because of the person who was departing from that position, Nathan Marcus Adler, who would go on to become the chief rabbi of England, was leaving that job to take the job in Hanover from his father. And so Adler, who was from a prestigious rabbinic family and was already who was a few years older than Hirsch and more accomplished, if he's leaving that job, it means it must be a reputable position. And it's the kind of job Hirsch can get. But there aren't that many jobs he could possibly get, for the simple reason that in a traditional environment where there are learned laity, Hirsch doesn't know enough to be the rabbi. And where there's a radical laity, Hirsch is too ideologically frum, or practically frum, to be the rabbi. So he needs a place where the standard of scholarship doesn't really matter, and the ideological perspective of the rabbi doesn't also really matter, because the community is indifferent to all these things. And the entity that wants the job to be filled is the government itself. Now, what does the government want from the Landesrabbiner in Oldenburg? They want the rabbi to keep the Jewish people in that district away from subversive and radical trends. Politically. Religiously, they probably don't even care. But politically, keep the Jews away from subversive trends. So the job of the rabbi is, aside from paskening shilas about the status of the chicken, was to figure out how to keep these people in line. All right? And Hirsch does a very good job of that, an excellent job of that. He's a good team player. Yeah?
Considering his background, you say grandfather was a masculine.
Uh-huh.
But there was still some rabbanis in that family. I'm surprised. okay, they sent him to a public school that they didn't hire a tutor, you know, like...
Uh-huh.
Studies as he was growing up.
Well, he did learn. He learned a little bit, but not enough to have an impressive resume, or for that matter, to wow the crowd in a Talmudically educated community. And that will be his problem in his next job. Well, the next two jobs, he'll run into a problem with people know more than he does, and he's the chief rabbi. So. In Oldenburg, well, when he was suggested for the position, Adler writes a letter of recommendation. But he refers to Hirsch as the young man. Now, the young man makes sense in terms of age. He was only 22. That's a pretty young age to become a rabbi in a kehillah. All right? But the young man, he doesn't refer to him as Rabbi Hirsch. What does that possibly tell you? That he didn't have smicha, correct. We don't know whether Ettlinger gave Samson Raphael Hirsch smicha, or maybe he didn't. Now, if he didn't, it's because it wasn't called for, so it didn't happen. But nonetheless, Hirsch was a student of the Talmud and of the Rabbanut, and so he was a reasonable candidate for a peripheral position on the edge of Jewish society, where you don't really need a high qualified candidate. If he did have smicha, why would Ettlinger give it to someone who was just the young man? If he didn't deserve it, why would he get it? So this is in the subjunctive. We don't really know if this is this what happened, but we could speculate why he might have had smicha, even if he didn't really deserve it. And the answer is, because from the standpoint of a guy like Isaac Bernays or Jacob Ettlinger or Nathan Marcus Adler, Samson Raphael Hirsch is a good choice for the German rabbinate, since he comes from a German Jewish family. He's interested in being a rabbi. He has good yichus. He has moderate and acceptable ideological and theological viewpoints. He has not made radical reforms, and he's not a Polish malamed. So, since he's not a Polish malamed and he's not a reform shegetz, he's a good candidate for a position that needs to be filled. Therefore, give him the ordination and let him go out into the world and do his best.
Better him than anybody.
Right.
Whatever else
was out there. Correct.
If he didn't get ordination the first time out, did he get ordination later on?
We don't know. I don't have any evidence of that.
So, I know this is on tape, but is it possible that he was now got some
information? It's possible. It's possible. It's not the biggest crime. It's perfectly okay for someone to function in the clergy without formal ordination.
In England, did they have the reverends?
In England, they were all reverends, except for the chief rabbi, because the chief rabbis refused to countenance the existence of another official rabbi anywhere on the island. Okay, so...
I think you intimated that there were more qualified candidates. So.
No, I'm saying that he... That at least in this case... He is what is a good candidate given the job description. In some of his later positions, or sought-after positions, there will be other candidates who far outpace him in scholarship, and sometimes he won't get the job. Okay, so...
But he called himself rabbi.
Yes, he did. He was the Landesrabbiner. That was his job.
That was his title,
yes.
So
he was.
He took the Rabbiner afterwards and ditched the Dutton Land.
Okay, so his sermons were in High German, and they were full of platitudes. But that was what he was supposed to do, to give the people moderate religion and keep them in line. And he did a good job of it. But while he was in Oldenburg, he was active as a writer and as a propagandist for Orthodoxy. His most important work while he was in Oldenburg was probably the 19 Letters of Ben Uziel, in which there's this fictional conversation between the teacher and Benjamin, the disciple, who has questions about religion. It was a polemical work to strengthen the Orthodox convictions of those who were questioning their orthodoxy. He also wrote a year later Horeb, which is a compendium of Jewish laws giving a rational interpretation of the laws. In this respect, he is a successor to Mendelssohn, in that it was clear... It was clear in the Enlightenment phase, in the post-Enlightenment era, that you have two choices. You can either reform religion or rationalize traditional religion. So some guys went the reform route, like Geiger, but others, like Hirsch, rationalized traditional practice, gave acceptable modern explanations for the religious usages that have been around for centuries and millennia. Okay, and these writings impressed a certain audience. The one person who was most impressed by the writings of Hirsch from his Oldenburg era was Heinrich Goetz. Heinrich Goetz, who goes on to be the great Jewish historian of the 19th century, writes the Geschichte der Juden, History of the Jews, and is a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary at Breslau, and the number two man in positive historical Judaism, only behind Frankl, was in his youth greatly attracted to the writings of Samson Raphael Hirsch, to the extent that he moved to Oldenburg and lived with the family in Hirsch's home for 3 years. He was his idol, his hero. Hirsch was the idol of Goetz from 1837 to 1840. So Goetz himself was questioning everything, but was looking to sustain traditional belief and traditional observance. And he thought that Hirsch represented a new style of traditionalism that could capture the hearts and minds of those who are young, impressionable, and educated. But their relationship eventually soured, and Hirsch didn't get along. Goetz didn't get along with Hirsch's wife. There were problems in the home. But aside from that, Goetz came to realize that he had misplaced his trust in Hirsch's ability to craft a new form of Judaism, a modern, successful Judaism. Instead, what did Hirsch have? Shulchan Aruchism. And Goetz was turned off by the Shulchan Aruchism of Hirsch, that everything was the last jot and tittle of the law as codified by Yosef Karo in the 1560s. And Goetz said that Hirsch doesn't know anything other than his big books of halachic literature, meaning he's an ignoramus when it comes to secular studies. That's not a nice thing to say, but there may be an element of truth. After all, Hirsch left university after a year and a half, was not a rabbi doctor, and was really just a pedagogue. He was a local rabbi who was a sitter lamdan, and according to the very holy rollers, he was an amaretz. So Goetz turns against Hirsch despite their early warm relationship. Joanna. I don't know her yichus. I don't know. No. So, what does Hirsch do while in Oldenburg? He abolishes Kol Nidre, as we mentioned in the past, and also is not particularly fond of certain other aesthetically unimpressive rituals. So in his Chorab Compendium of Laws, he leaves out Tashlich, Kaparus, and Chibut Arava. What is Chibut Arava? The smacking of the willow on Hoshana Rabbah. So certain things that the reformers would delete altogether, he intellectually leaves it out of the compendium. That's not to say he didn't do it.
Was Kol Nidre in there?
Kol Nidre was deleted in 1839 from the liturgy. No. Because it's problematic, the Goyim think Jews are untrustworthy, therefore to avoid problems of the Jewish oath and suspicion vis-a-vis emancipation, get rid of Kol Nidre in the hopes that Jews will be seen as upstanding citizens who could be trusted. Okay. While in Oldenburg, Hirsch earned a salary from the government. He didn't have to rely upon the kehillah for his salary. He was a paid employee of the government. And in Chorev, he said, a Jew has to listen to the law of the land, the din de malchusa. And even if the local government is tyrannical, whether it's democratic or it's tyrannical, you render unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar and unto God what belongs to God. And so you have to be a patriotic citizen no matter what, even if this is not the ideal environment for Jews, and even if Jews are not fully emancipated. In that regard, I could say that most rabbis would have disagreed with him. Certainly the progressive rabbis wouldn't have liked that, but even some of the traditional rabbis would not have liked his absolutist approach towards capitulating to the government. Okay. Gretz wanted Hirsch to move on and assume a more prestigious position. Now, why? If Gretz turned against Hirsch and thought he was just a Shulchan Aruch Jew who wasn't all that impressive, why would he want the man to have a better rabbinical position? The answer is, well, who else is going to take the better rabbinical positions? You want a Polish Malamed to become one of the rabbis in the German cities? No, you don't want that. And if you believe in traditional Judaism, you don't want one of these Reform rabbis who's a Hefe Shegetz. So you want a rabbi who's a traditional rabbi, but a German rabbi at that, and even if he's not so enlightened and not so prestigious when it comes to academic qualifications, better him than somebody else. So, Gretz says, take one of these other jobs that are available. What was available? Posen was available, because Rabbi Akiva Eger died in 1839, and another job that was available was in Wolstein, where Samuel Monk had died. But Hirsch was reluctant to leave Oldenburg for a few reasons. One, he was a bourgeois individual who liked getting a nice salary, and he didn't want to take a chance on another rabbinic position where his salary might not be as high. And with a wife and eventually 10 kids, he's got to worry about Parnassa. So don't rock the boat when you have Parnassa, even if there's a better position elsewhere. Also, he was afraid to go anywhere to the east, because what happens in the east? Jews know Talmud, they're more frum. And he's afraid, what am I going to do? I don't know enough to compete with those guys. Ultimately, he leaves Oldenburg and goes to East Friesland, which is another community in northwest Germany, where the main city there was Emden. And he stays there from 1841 to 1847. We're not exactly sure why he went there, and while he was there, he was subject to the Kehillah for his salary. He was not a paid employee of the government. He needed to get along with the congregants, but he didn't get along with the congregants, and he wanted out. And so in 1842, he already has his eyes on another prize. Solomon Herschel died. Who was Solomon Herschel? The chief rabbi of England. And so for the next 2 years, the British Jews are deciding who's going to be the next chief rabbi. So there were 13 candidates, and Hirsch made it down to the final four. He made it to the final four. But Nathan Marcus Adler was in that final four. And when it came to tallying the votes, there were 134 votes. And of the 134, Nathan Marcus Adler got 127, and Hirsch got 2. He was way out of his league. He should never have applied for the job, but in his pride, he thought he was a qualified candidate, and it wounded his pride terribly, the fact that he did so poorly in the running. Okay. So he has to stay in East Friesland until 1847. Not really happy to be there, but he does whatever he can. He doesn't write much in the 1840s. It was not a productive period for him in terms of literature. But it was a productive period in terms of developing a public profile, in that it was the high point of the Reform movement. The Reform rabbinical conferences are 1844 to 46. And what does Hirsch do? He establishes himself as a staunch opponent of Reform. He was a moderate rabbi beforehand. And the dividing line between Reform and what would emerge as neo-orthodoxy was still very much amorphous. But by the 1840s, you can no longer have a vague opinion about things. You have to develop a firm opinion. And he becomes the staunch enemy of the Reform. Okay. He leaves. Well, before he leaves to go to his next job, he develops a few enemies. He refers to Samuel Holtheim as an idolatrous Yeravam. Oive. Who is Yeravam? Yeravam ben Nevat, who was the founder of the Northern Kingdom, the breakaway from the kingdom of the Davidic dynasty, and he puts idols in Beit El and Dan. So in the history of the Bible, Yeravam ben Nevat is a villain, okay? And he calls Samuel Holtheim, the radical reformer, an idolatrous Yeravam. With terminology like that, you're not going to make too many friends. Because he believed it.
I know, but what was... that's a Hillsonger. Oh, I was so...
But you have to be an educated person to understand what he's cussing.
Yeah, yes, yes. Okay. So, Hirsch denied that traditional Judaism was incompatible with loyalty to the state. Now, bear in mind that in the high point of the Reform rabbinical movement in the 1840s, one of their claims was that old line Judaism is incompatible with modern citizenship.
We had that here with American Reform.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. Yes.
This is American Judaism. That's
right. So the argument was that old line Judaism was incompatible with citizenship for a wide range of reasons, one of which is the dual loyalty of the return to Zion component that has been debunked time and time again. But the other was that if you abide by the laws of, let's say, the Sabbath or Kashrut or the laws against intermarriage, you create for yourself an isolated enclave where you're not interacting with the rest of society, and you're on your own, you're not part of the broader community of citizens. And so that claim is something Hirsch had to debunk. And he said, no, Orthodoxy, or traditional Judaism, is compatible with citizenship. The only thing that he conceded was there are certain state jobs that a traditional Jew could not accept for themselves because of the Sabbath or other ritual considerations. But that's not to the detriment of the state. That's just an obstacle and a drawback for the traditional Jew. Meaning society is not in any way injured. The state is not injured by the fact that I, as an Orthodox Jew, can't become a barrister or a judge because court is open on Saturday. It just means I'm disadvantaged and that I can't get that job. I might otherwise be qualified, but I can't do it because my religious scruples. So what is Hirsch then doing? He's saying you can be a traditional Jew and a good citizen, but there's a price to be paid in that in your personal life you become effectively a second-class citizen because of the congenital disease known as Judaism, that you're held back by what you can't do on account of religious obstacles.
That should make the Jew in the street feel very lousy.
So, right, it makes the Jew on the street feel very lousy and is a reason to become a Reform Jew. In other words, let's jettison all the burdensome, the cumbersome aspects of Judaism, and then nothing will get in our way of full participation in the civic life. So how then can Hirsch say to the young Jew, stay traditional? The answer is, you got to grin and bear it. It's for the sake of our ancestors, for the sake of fealty to the ancestral religion, but more importantly, he will stress doctrine, revelation, the divine component of Judaism, that God commanded this. So therefore, whether we like it or not, if it's a divine command, revealed law, we don't have the option of saying goodbye to it. That's where his orthodoxy joins his orthopraxy. His orthopraxy is, you gotta keep the tradition. You can't violate the halacha. His orthodoxy is, and the reason why? Because God gave the law. God gave the law.
But wasn't this the time in the 19th century where in order to get ahead, you were going to convert to Christianity?
Yes, some people did. Plenty of people did. Although the wave of conversions to Christianity kind of petered out by 1830, which is before Hirsch's time. I mean, before his era in the rabbinate. Yeah.
So Hirsch was taking on the role of arguing the religious perspective against the Reform movement, which had a cadre of leaders.
Yes.
Why did he choose to take this on himself rather than form a coalition of like-minded rabbis?
He's not the type to form a coalition of anything. He was a separatist by nature, who didn't necessarily work well with others. But also, there isn't a cadre of others for him to work with. Later on, there'll be Israel Hildesheimer, who will move from Hungary to Berlin in 1869 and become the other pillar of German neo-Orthodoxy. But in the earlier phases, in the 1840s and 1850s, there aren't that many avowedly Orthodox, but educated and modern rabbis. There are some middle-of-the-roaders who we've discussed, the Frankels of the world, but there aren't that many who fit the description of Hirsch. Okay, so whereas Holdheim said that Dina de Malchuta Dina, the law of the land is the law, should result in the diminution of Judaism to just a handful of rituals, but that Choshen Mishpat, civil law, Jewish civil law is gone. The Beit Din is gone. The juridical status of the rabbis gone. The whole times of the world, the reformers, they want to get rid of all these aspects of old line ghetto Judaism. Whereas Hirsch says, we'll get rid of it if the government coerces us to get rid of it. If the government says you can no longer have Beit Din and you have to go to civil courts, so be it. We'll lose whatever components of Judaism we have to lose, but we don't want to throw it out just because we feel like it. We don't feel like it. Yeah.
Hirsch seems to be a defender of the government and the status quo.
Yes.
And neocon for his time, in contradistinction, with the reformers of the 1840s, not only reformers religiously, but were they also liberal politically?
Ah, okay, so I'm glad you asked that, because that's the very next point I was going to talk about. Hirsch moves to Nicholsburg. He's moved to Nicholsburg in 1847. Nicholsburg was the seat of the Moravian chief rabbi. Now, Moravia is in the Habsburg Empire. It's, you have Bohemia, which is the Czech lands, and Moravia. It was a bad move on his part, because Moravian Jewry in the 1840s was still very traditional and very learned, and he didn't fit in. He was a Western Jew. They were really Eastern Jews along of the more Polish variety. But in 1848, you have a big rebellion. And the Habsburgs are temporarily ousted from power. They have to capitulate to certain demands of the people. And in the hagiography, Hirsch is credited with petitioning the government very eloquently for emancipation. And he's credited with securing Jewish emancipation in Moravia. Nonsense. He was brand new. He was in a non-Germanic province. And he was an outsider. He was not leading the charge for emancipation. He was the type, as you said, to favor conservative government. Who was then the leader of Jewry in the Habsburg lands who favored emancipation? Isaac Noah Mannheimer, who was the preacher in Vienna. He was the modern preacher, not a rabbi, but the pastor, the Jewish pastor of the Viennese Rite. He led the charge for emancipation. He was a political liberal. Many of the reformers were political liberals. Hirsch really was not. He likes emancipation, although he recognizes after 1848 that there is a price for emancipation. And what is that? Jews no longer have to affiliate. And if Jews don't have to affiliate, then the smaller communities run the risk of becoming defunct. What happens if the Jews don't have to pay their dues to the Kehila? And they're not especially frum. They're not going to pay. And then there's no Kehila, which means there are no religious services offered. So it's a big problem, emancipation, if it also includes the right to walk away from religious involvement. Okay. Now, in Moravia, Hirsch has a problem. He has to do away with the Talmudic discourses because the audience knows more than he does. He changes the Yiddish drasha into the German predikt, the sermon. And he changes the focus of his learning and his public discourses from Talmud to Bible, especially the Pentateuch, the Chamisha Chumashei Torah, about which he would write a commentary, the Hirsch commentary, and Psalms, the Tehillim. To which his detractors said that in the old days people studied Talmud and recited Psalms. Now they study Psalms and recite the Talmud. Like they daven the daf, you know, like the daf yomi is often they just mumble it. Okay. So, some local rabbis were so turned off by Hirsch that they refused to give him even basic courtesies. He was officially their boss or their overseer, and they would not give him basic courtesies. He did certain things to antagonize Moravian Jewry, which was a traditional Jewry. One, he did weddings in shul. It's a big no-no. Weddings in the synagogue, big no-no. Secondly, in the wedding in the shul, he allowed the mother of the bride to walk her down the aisle, which was in the men's section. And it's been, you're not allowed to bring women into the men's section. And also, he held hands with his wife while strolling in public. Oy vey. So this was not to the liking of the local community. So he had to get out of Moravia.
Why couldn't she not get married in shul? I don't understand.
Because the synagogue is a place of worship of God, not a place of life cycle occasions, and a wedding is a secular function.
And churches had weddings.
And churches had weddings, yeah. So okay. You cannot get married in a shul, yeah? Okay. So, in 1851, he has to get away. At the age of 43, with a wife and five sons and five daughters, he picks up and moves to Frankfurt am Main to become the rabbi of the IRG, the Breakaway Orthodox Congregation, the Israelite Religions Gesellschaft. In 1843, Leopold Stein became the rabbi in Frankfurt. He replaced the elderly Salomon Schreier, who resigned over a Reform Orthodox battle. Stein was a Reform rabbi. And so the traditionalists in Frankfurt were dissatisfied with the Kehillah and were looking for an alternative. In 1849, they broke away and created, with the permission of the Frankfurt Senate, a separatist organization. Now, they were still members of the Kehillah because you were not allowed to formally break away. Every Jew had to be a member of the Kehillah, but you could establish an alternative while simultaneously paying dues to the main parent congregation. Who did they want for their rabbi? So initially they wanted Michael Sachs. Michael Sachs was one of these middle-of-the-road guys who became the rabbi in Berlin. But he was not avowedly Orthodox. He was kind of in the mold of Frankl, maybe a little bit more Frum than Frankl. And so it goes to show you that the IIG was not positively Orthodox in its orientation. It was simply anti-Reform. It was waiting for some authoritative figure to come along and mold them in his image. And Hirsch would do that when he arrives on the scene. One of the first things he does is establish a school for Torah Miderech Eretz, Torah with the way of the world. And the liberals attacked it. And the best thing that ever happened to Hirsch was that the liberals attacked it, because it meant that that it was less objectionable in the eyes of the fundamentalist Orthodox. Because if the Reform liberals think it's treif, it must be that it's good. So the very Frum think it's good. Okay. Hirsch was a master polemicist, and he attracted many wealthy people to his cause of the IIG, including the ham-eating Orthodox. Now, what are the ham-eating Orthodox? The Chazar Fressing Orthodox. They are people who in their personal lives are not especially pious. But in what they want from public religion, they want old world religion. And they are turned off by anything that is overly progressive. And such people existed in significant numbers in Frankfurt and all over Germany.
Yeah?
Okay, good. That's it exists to this day. So, Samson Raphael Hirsch did exactly what the Reformers did. He localized Judaism to the synagogue, meaning what makes you a Frum Jew, at least an Orthodox Jew for these purposes, the fact that the liturgy you say is the Orthodox one and there's a machitza in your shul. What you do in the privacy of your own home doesn't really matter, which means that in order to join his organization, the IIG, there were only two criteria. You had to be circumcised, and yet you could not be married contrary to the halakha. Meaning if you married a non-Jew, or you were a Kohen who married a divorcee, if you had an illegitimate marriage, you could not join. But if you were a Chazer Fresser, or you were Machal Shabbos when no one was looking, it didn't matter. Judaism was localized to the synagogue, and if the synagogue was a legit synagogue, then you were an Orthodox Jew. And he needed their money, because he could not build the kind of institutions he wanted to build without the kesef that came from the irreligious Orthodox. Okay.
Set of beliefs, or they always adapt to the location?
No, he definitely had a core set. He had absolutely had a core set of beliefs. He believed in the binding character of the halakha and divine revelation of the Torah and the oral law, which leads me to my next point. In 1854, we're running out of time, he asks Frankl to clarify what is the agenda of the Jewish Theological Seminary at Breslau. And what did Frankl respond?
No.
He didn't. He snubbed Hirsch. Why did he snub Hirsch? Because Zacharia Frankl was for many years the rabbi in Dresden, a big city, a big Jewish community in Germany. And then he becomes the rector of the Jewish Theological Seminary, a prestigious position. What is Samson Raphael Hirsch? A nobody. Okay, he's a nobody. How so? Because he's the rabbi of a separatist congregation within Frankfurt. He's not the rabbi of Frankfurt. He had been the rabbi of Moravia, but he's not the rabbi of Moravia anymore. He has no official position in a recognized Jewish kehillah. He's just the rabbi of a breakaway shtiebel, basically. And so since he has no formal position, he can be ignored by the machers of the German rabbinate. So Frankl ignores Hirsch. He snubs him, doesn't give him an answer. So what does Hirsch do? He picks fights with people. He picks a fight with Frankl over the Darkei HaMishnah, which we spoke about a number of weeks ago, and he picks a fight with his former disciple Gretz over the history of the Jews, the Geschichte der Juden, claiming that Gretz wrote complete fantasies. Why did he attack Gretz? Because Gretz's history does not exactly toe the Orthodox party line on the history of the development of the halakha. So Hirsch is a fighter for Orthodox beliefs and calls out those in the public sphere whom he believes have departed from doctrinal orthodoxy. Okay. In the last 2 minutes we have tonight, because we'll stop early because of the Tehillim downstairs, Hirsch is important for Auschwitz, for secession. In Germany, you had to be a member of your local religious community, regardless of what religious faith you were a part of, Christian or Jew. But the Auschwitz Gazettes, the secession law was passed in 1870, I believe, which allowed Christians to break away from the local church and form their own confession of the, in a manner of their choosing. They did not have to belong to the parent body. But that law, when it was first passed, did not apply to Jews. Jews still had to be members of the local kehillah, even if they thought that it was no good, meaning even if it was Reform and they were Orthodox, or it was Orthodox and they were Reform. You had no choice. Therefore, the members of Hirsch's shul have to be members of a kehillah that is run by a Reform rabbi. Hirsch believes that is unfair religious discrimination. And he says it's usur, it's forbidden to join such a kehillah. Why? Because you're paying money in taxes to fund heresy, apikorsut. You're paying for the Reform rabbi's salary who's teaching heresy in Mishigasin. It's forbidden. You have to be a separatist. And in 1876, with the help of Edward Lasker, a Jewish parliamentarian who was a real liberal and believed in freedom of conscience, it was determined by the parliament that Jews are now also free to secede from their kehilot if they have religious objections to membership in the kehilah. So did the Jews of Frankfurt secede if they were members of Hirsch's shul just because their rabbi told them to do so? No. The rabbi said do it, and the people didn't listen. Why not? Because the people had long-standing attachments to the Gemeinde, to the community. Their parents, their grandparents, their great-grandparents were members of that Gemeinde and built it up. The Chevra Kadisha, the cemetery, the mikveh, the whatever communal institutions existed, their immediate ancestors were involved in building it and paying for it and sustaining it. So just because Rabbi Hirsch says it's all heresy, we have to get away from it, they're not going to listen. Only those people who owed their parnasa, their salary, their livelihood to Hirsch, meaning the people who taught in his cheder and the people who worked in his shul, seceded, because they thought they'd get fired if they didn't. But basically, if you didn't owe your parnasa to the chief to the rabbi of the shul, you didn't listen to him and you stayed a member of the community. Hirsch's decision to protest the Gemeinde Orthodox, the communal Orthodox, led to the inability of the Gemeinde to service the needs of the Orthodox Jews who were not members of the IRG. And no rabbi wanted to become the Orthodox rabbi in Frankfurt because Hirsch was going to call you a heretic. It took chutzpah from Marcus Horowitz in 1878 to become the rabbi of the non-separatist Orthodox. And they never got along. Okay, we'll stop here. Tehillim time.